It was the year of deep geeking.
The year of Feedbackapalooza.
The year we discussed our favorite show.
It was the year without Zima.
The year of great tequila.
The year of puns.
And a year of more interviews.
It was a new chance for fun.
It was the end of the series.
It was the year we made it to Crusade.
The year is 2009. The show, Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
Happy Turkey Day from us turkeys to you turkeys. It's that time of year again. Actually, we're recording this prior to Thanksgiving, but you're listening to it while you are still... No, wait, you're probably listening to this with a wing in your mouth right now. There's a good chance of that, isn't it?
Or a drumstick, exactly.
A drumstick. Yeah. A Drazi drumstick.
Ooh. Or a Pac Moran wishbone.
I always listen to this show with a wing and a prayer, so that's nothing new.
Very nice. That's good. That was funny stuff.
Oh,
yep. Thanksgiving. And so happy Thanksgiving to all of you.
Thank you very much. Happy Thanksgiving to you. Yeah. And also wish me luck because I am running a 10K on Thanksgiving Day with my brother and sisters.
Wow.
Wow, yeah. You should probably let them run next to you because I don't think you should carry them the whole way. It's hard for your knees.
And I've been doing that for so many years. It's just it's tragic. It's tough being the oldest sometimes.
Wow.
It really is.
Is this to build up an appetite for Thanksgiving dinner or just something?
I have a feeling that in the end we won't be particularly hungry. I've been training for this for some time now. I find that I don't really want to eat a whole lot after I finished running, so
need much.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's great. Exactly. I'm proud of you. You've done very well in the last year. You've been working hard at it. And you've hurt yourself a bunch doing it too.
Yes, and that's healed up and doing well, and I actually got out for a run this morning and did quite well, and it was a longer run than I've done. And you know, pushing my limits, and it's a cool thing.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Fantastical.
Yeah.
So, what do we got on store? Oh, hey, we had something. Summer told me. Actually, Summer told both of us today. There was some news that you wanted to share. Some condolences.
Yes.
We need
to send out our thoughts to Peter Woodward because his father, Edward Woodward, who played Alwyn on Crusade, and also one of my favorite shows, The Equalizer. He passed away earlier this week.
Yeah, and Peter, of course, was Galen.
Yes.
For those who just, you know, are not full-scale, authorized, card-carrying geeks.
Yeah.
And he's a sweet man, just a terrific guy. So, heartfelt thoughts to Peter and his family. Mm-hmm.
How old was Edward when he passed?
78 or 79.
Okay.
Wow, that's a good run, though.
That's great.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, what else you got?
Well, I was going to say, at this point, if you're listening to this, it's already happened. But as we're recording this, Atlantis has docked with the International Space Station.
Yeah, just a couple of hours ago.
Right, exactly. Delivering spare parts and supplies, and from what I heard and have read, it's supposed to be what they need to keep that space station in orbit for another decade.
Yeah.
So, given our earlier conversations about deorbiting the thing, I think it's not likely that that's going to happen anytime soon.
No, I didn't. You know, that was funny when we brought that up. I had not heard anything about deorbiting because we were still just building it. So you don't like.
Put it together to destroy it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, many children actually do that. that they had packed the Atlantis to the gills with just every stinking thing they could think of. And if they had room, they said, okay, we've got X, you know, square inches left. You know, what else you got? I don't know. Stick some more of this in there. Give them every possibly can. And by the time you're listening to this podcast, STS-129 should be returning. I believe it's the day after Thanksgiving, right?
I think so.
Is when it's scheduled to return, right? So,
yeah.
So, Gary, while you're down there in Jackson, be listening for the boom boom when it comes back home.
Yeah.
I never understood that, because when I heard the news that they were planning on, you know, deorbiting it, my first thought was, you guys are still putting it together. This isn't like this is not Legos. This thing should be planned there for 50 years, not 10. What's going on?
I was going to say that the engineers must have been really big erector set people. You know, they just, you know, they got it together. Oh, it's done. Okay, tear it apart. What else are we going to build now?
Right, right. Well, we gave you money to build it. We didn't say anything about keeping it up and working.
I mean, is it just me? I mean, it doesn't make sense to spend more time building it than to have it have, you know, an active life as a fully functional station.
Let me also offer this up.
Okay, go ahead.
Given the cynical attitude that even hardcore space buffs like Jeffrey and myself have regarding some decisions that have been made from NASA offices, as preposterous as it may seem, it's not outside the realm of possibility that some bureaucrat would come up with that idea. And so that's why I think we gave the rumor more credence than it actually deserved.
Possibly.
Well, no, you're onto it, because it's not unlikely to conceive that that NASA and U.S. funding said, okay, we'll build the thing and you guys contribute and you build your little part, you know, Japan, and you build your part, Italy, and you build your part, you know, Europe, and everybody would kind of come together and give us some extra parts and stuff. But we'll take up the lion's share of the expense to create the thing. But then up to you guys to be either renting space from us or paying us back or making the contribution. You guys are going to pick up the load after we get it up and running.
Right.
Now, I don't know. I have nothing to validate that. I'm just, you know.
No, I know. Exactly. That's, yeah.
Well, you know, I see, and I look at it as, why deorbit the thing? Let's sell it. You know, sell it to somebody. Somebody will take it.
Richard Branson, right?
Yeah, there you go. Richard Branson.
Michael Armenengay. He already owns.
Yeah,
hey, exactly. We'll start a new FAR fund. I'm all for that. Sounds like a good idea.
You know, and let's not mix the stories here, because while the end of the shuttle program is imminent, it at no point does that automatically mean that there's an end to the space station ISS program. For the time being, the Russian Soyuz project still works very well to get stuff up and down, get people back and forth. It's not as robust and clever as our space shuttle is, but it does the job, and it's been working, and can continue to do that until we have the next space vehicle ready to go.
Actually, right. I have the story right in front of me if we want to actually do facts on this show. I don't know why, but International Space Station to deorbit in 2016 due to lack of long-term funding. That is basically what they're saying. Huffington Post is reporting on that right now. And basically then it was supposed to go longer than this, but unfortunately due to cutbacks and funding and other projects that were taking precedence, the ISS will be deorbited in 2016 so that they do not have to spend any more money on it. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. If that was the case, why are you sending the shuttle up there with all that stuff?
Well, 2016, I mean, that's still, you know, 6 years down the road, so.
Yeah,
we'll see. A lot can change. Exactly.
Yeah, so you never know. Somebody will.
That's right.
I think we should start a fund. It's time for a drive. Save the space station.
I believe firmly that if just outside the edges of the space station, both where the shuttle docks and the Soyuz docks, that if they would have just simply put parking meters there, there would have been a cash stream happening that just could have easily kept everything going for a little while longer.
Run out honeymoon suites. Well,
there's a question. What magnification level telescope do you need to see the space station as it whizzes by?
Oh, you don't need it at all. You can see it with the bare eyes.
No, you see a little shiny thing flashing by. That is not enough resolution for the human eye to actually see the Taco Bell logo or the Pepsi.
That's what they need. They need a you know, 1,000-foot-long banners trailing behind
it. It's pulling behind it.
Yeah. Now, seriously, what would it take to put the, you know, the newfangled Pepsi logo on one of the arms, and how do you make it visible to human eyes? Going, it's like, hey, there's a space station. Look in the telescope. Pepsi, a new generation. Okay, cool.
I wonder how much the Farpoint logo would take on it. You know, it's themed. It works good on the ISS. You could have it out there on the arm or something, you know, on one of the camera shots. I wonder how much that they'd charge us for that.
And the space station does kind of glow like the back of your head when you go to that other video shot.
There you go. Absolutely. I'm all about the shininess, you bet.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That was mean. Hey, can I have a little thing that I'd like, if you indulge me, in the pre-production process for this episode. Yes, I know. Laugh and fume up.
If you listen to the live stream or you watch the live video feed, you'd have heard all the discussion. It was really intense.
I actually found, you know, I said, okay, you know, they never like when I do all the jokes, but I said, let me go see if I can find a Thanksgiving joke. So I found one of the old basic. This is a joke that's been around forever and ever, and you've probably heard it. And I read through it, and I thought, oh, that's not a, you know, that's an oldie. Let me tell that one, or not tell that one. But as I read it, I actually found a B5 reference that I attached to. So let me read this joke to you, and then I'll tell you why I thought it tied together. Okay, this will fit into the show, and this will get us to the break. Okay,
you're so clever.
I know. it's not my first time in the picnic. Okay, a man in Phoenix calls his son in New York the day before Thanksgiving and says, I hate to ruin your day, but I have to tell you that your mother and I are divorcing. 45 years of misery is enough. And the son says, Pop, what are you talking about? And the father says, well, we can't stand the sight of each other any longer. We're sick of each other, and I'm sick of talking about this. So call your sister in Chicago and tell her. Frantic, the son calls the sister, who explodes on the phone and says, like heck, they're getting divorced. She shouts, I'll take care of this. She immediately calls Phoenix and screams at the father, you are not getting a divorce. Don't do a single thing until I get there. I'm calling my brother back, and we'll both be there tomorrow. Do you hear me? Don't do a thing until we get there. And bam, she hangs up. The old man turns to his wife and says, okay, they're coming for Thanksgiving, and they're paying their own way.
Yeah.
Okay. Like that. So here's the thought that I, yeah, exactly. Old joke. But here's the thought when I read through that, I said to myself, you know what? That is exactly how Sheridan would have handled the situation. that is his kind of cunning that he would have thrown a rope to the Drazi and thrown a rope to the Narn and told them both something that they absolutely, and he would have got them into the same room so that they could work out differences or something like that. That's exactly how John Sheridan would have handled things. So that was my little B5 Thanksgiving story I thought I'd share.
Very nice.
You appreciated the sneakiness, the sly wit therein.
There you go. Exactly. Which he has demonstrated time and time again.
There you go. All right.
Now you can go to break.
All right. Well, we are going to take a very, very quick break and come back with some deep geeking on, what is this?
Darkness Ascending.
Yes.
So you want to know what this Twitter thing is all about, do you? Give me 10 minutes and I'll give you the lowdown on this 140-character craze Time Magazine calls the latest innovation in communication. Hi, I'm T. Morris, and I host Birdhouse Rules, the official podcast of Q's Publishing, All a Twitter, and Sam's Teach Yourself Twitter in 10 Minutes, both available in bookstores everywhere. The Birdhouse Rules keeps you in the know on hot topics, helpful tools, and latest upgrades in the Twitterverse. So wipe your feet at the door, don't even think about changing the channel on the plasma, and come on, no DMing from the dinner table. It's my house, my rules. Birdhouse Rules. Subscribe on iTunes or at birdhouserules.com.
digging down into the most obscure facts and fandom. This is BGE.
And we return, delving into the core, the meat, the heart, the painful, painful emotional struggle that is the final act of season 5.
Yes. Yes, Darkness Ascending. You know, I really like the title of this too, because, you know, you think of, for example, the Fall of Night, and you think of darkness as something that descends down from the sky. This is like evil coming up from beneath and rising to take control, or darkness, I should say, not necessarily specifically evil. And
see, that's what I had right there on my notes there. I wrote notes and I said, Darkness Ascending. Wait, that makes no sense to me. That's ironic. It's oxymoronish. It's just not right.
Yeah.
Darkness
but it's so correct. And in the opening scene with Garibaldi's dream.
Yes.
You know, it's the perfect embodiment of that.
The Garibaldi's dream is one of those things where it's so visceral. You know, the message is trying to send to him, and yet he still doesn't heed its warning. I mean, it's literally right there in his face.
Yeah.
It stands up out of the darkness of his own soul, his own psyche, and says, here I am. What are you going to do about it? And he caves. He caves. Garibaldi isn't the kind of guy who caves.
Well, yeah, he is. He's a drunk. Hello.
Right, exactly. I was going to say that.
Remind you,
of
anybody?
But that's the thing. I mean, it's even so outrageously obvious. You know, his dream self shows up with that huge video game weapon.
A BFG. You know?
Right, exactly. But that's the whole point. It is just that huge. It is so outlandish, and it's so outlandishly obvious. And yet he still refuses to acknowledge the reality of his situation. And when Lise shows up and confronts him, you know, finds the bottle under the sink, you know, he tries to convince her it's different this time. You know, and really is he's just continuing the denial and the lies.
Yeah, he's not trying to convince her. He's still trying to convince himself, because he's I guess I've never understood that exceptionally deep denial where you see he's really trying to convince himself, not her.
Yes. Well, because right.
What he says is, this is everything that's been done to me so far. This is the only thing I can control. And the fact that he can control his drinking is the illusion. So he's really not in control of anything. And he's using it as an excuse to say, okay, I'm not in control of everything. I've given it all up.
Right, exactly. And that's the nature of that disease. You know, he is looking for excuses to allow him to continue with self-destructive behavior. And he's using that as rationality, and he's doing the whole thing. You know, you don't know what I've been through. Nobody understands. You know, Lisa's comment I loved is like, so it's okay if you're driving off the road as long as you're at the wheel.
Yeah.
You know, and his response is yes. You know, that doesn't get through to him.
I have a production question about that for Jeffrey.
Yeah.
The BFG he held in the open, did somebody take that beastie home and have it in their closet? Or was that just a whole bunch of weapons just glued together for that day?
No, we actually, memory serves that the guys in the prop room actually had what do you call this thing? Can you see me on the screen? Can you see what I'm doing? What do you call those cabinets? You know, it's two doors and you open it up and it's like, you know, it's got some shelves and stuff in it.
Yeah, so cabinet. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a cabinet. Exactly. And it had all the gun tons of stuff in there. And they had stuff in there from the pilot and early on, because sometimes we would reuse some of that stuff in either background pieces and or it would get modified to use it again. A hero piece, but certainly as a backup piece or a background piece. So the specific gun you're asking about, I don't know that I remember that, but we actually had quite a nice little arsenal of cool stuff in there. Yeah.
And my second question is, the alcohol that Jerry Doyle was drinking, was that real? Was that tea or some other colored beverage, or was he really slipping some booze in there from time to time?
I have no knowledge of what you're speaking. Gee, that was a long time ago. I got nothing. I got nothing.
Just a question.
Yeah, just a question. One we can ponder for years.
There you go.
Yeah, and we will. And we will.
But the core of this episode is the discovery and the twists and the turns afterwards of who's responsible for the attacks.
Yes. And Lanier takes it upon himself to strike out on his own to find out what he can find out. He's got the lead from the Centauri transmission, and they already suspect the Centauri to begin with. So he's working on that. And, it's one of those where we've seen Lanier so far, where he's driven himself and caused some concern amongst those who care about him that maybe he's trying too hard. But the fact of the matter is that drive also makes him the ideal candidate for the job. And, you know, that's one of those ironies again, or at least those gray areas. It's like, you know, Lanier, he's joined the Rangers for the wrong reason, because he wants to be able to prove himself to Delenn and hopefully win her heart and her hand. But again, because of that, he knows the situation. He's been in the inner circle. He's aware of what the stakes are more than any other Ranger. And so he is willing to take the chance and risk his own life to go out and grab the evidence. And that scene between Delenn and Sheridan, where they confront each other over that choice, was fantastic.
Yeah. Like, he's like,
I've been working up a good man all day, and you are not gonna have by agreeing with me.
That is the line. That is the best line, where he's sitting. You could see that his rant was cut off at the knees, and he's got nowhere to go with it. And right. He's sitting there looking, going, wait, I had the perfect retort, the perfect speech. I had to get this off my chest, and you tell me I'm right? What?
Yeah. And that's Delenn's skill. She knows how to diffuse a situation. You know, she wasn't going in there waiting to get sandblasted by Mr. President. You know, she knew how to diffuse that and also turn it against him. You know, yeah, it was the wrong thing to do, but here's the reason why. And she also pointed out that he knew that Lanier was the right one, but didn't want to, you know, his error would have been because Lanier is her friend, that, you know, trying to protect her and Lanier by not sending him out. So it's like, this is what's really interesting about this whole plot line. There is all these little dances of people trying to do the right thing for the wrong reasons, and it's coming to a head, you know, and it is going to come crashing down around everybody's shoulder. So, you know, Lanier's gone off and Delenn was trying to protect Sheridan from, you know, knowing about this and bearing the responsibility and Sheridan. I love the bit he was sneaking around and catches her talking to Lanier, you know, and just kind of stays around the corner to catch. That's how he first learns of it and recalls the White Star. So there's that dance going on. Lanier takes off. He gets the information they need, but it's one of those things, like, now that they've got it, they have to follow through on it, and they know nothing good is going to come out of that.
Mm-hmm. I like how the argument that he was trying to protect her by not putting Lanier in harm's way actually came back to bite them when they thought he was missing or dead. And you have, you know, the pain on Delenn's face where she's like, he's not dead until I see the body. He's not dead. Yeah. He's not dead. I believe in him and his skills. He's not dead until I see his body.
Yeah, and Sheridan was trying to offer a measure of condolence by, you know, agreeing he was the right one. And you know, I mean, it was just...
he was trying to console her, and she cut him off. She's like, no, there's nothing to console. He's not gone yet, so don't even go there. And you see the pain in his eyes when she's doing this. And that was just brilliant, brilliant acting.
I think go ahead, Jeffrey. I'm sorry.
I just thought that I remember feeling that this was we were on the precipice of Lanier's finest moment. You know, that the way that this was written, the way that it started to unfold, that five seasons of Lanier kind of being this sidekick thing on the, that this was finally going to be his moment to score the big goal, you know, and win the game. It was I really thought it was going in that direction. And then all of a sudden all that everybody else was talking about, oh, it was over and he was dead and he was gone. And I just remember being very intrigued with the Lanier character finally, like really, 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 like this is his moment. It's coming. It's coming.
Yeah, that's a good point too, Jeffrey, because, you know, as you say, he's sort of the sidekick. He's come a long way from being that innocent acolyte in the temple to being, I don't want to say an action hero, but a man of decisive action who is willing to sacrifice himself for a greater good, and really doing it without any regrets. You know, again, and it does, it is all tied up with the whole reason, you know, he's doing it to try to impress Delenn and win her heart. But the fact is that he doesn't let that emotional component overwhelm what needs to be done to get the job done.
Right. And we have to remember that only we as the audience knew about his love for her.
Correct. Right.
You know, that was just something that we as the viewers were privy to, but he never let that out for even a second. You know,
right.
She suspected and she knew and she kept it all in check. You know, that was just something we were privy to.
Right, exactly. So Lanier gets that. And the one of the moving bits in there that just really tugged at my heart is he witnesses the attack of the Centauri ships, and there's that chilling cry, we've got children on board, and it blows up. And as that message comes across the radio waves, you know, he kind of turns his head with that, you know, that wince, like, oh my God, this is horrible. But he can't, you know, he knows he has to stay there to witness the whole thing. And that bit where, you know, the ship queries, you know, are you going to go into a you know, reduced life support state? And he goes, no, I'm going to wait and watch and pray. And it was like, oh, it was just so heartrending, because that was the thing, you know, again, that whole thing, that the innocence of Lanier has, if there was ever any shred of that, witnessing that tore it away. You know, that was out there where life and death were happening, and you know, and truly he was powerless to do anything about it, because to do anything about it would have revealed himself, and then his whole reason for being there would have been null and void.
Oh, you know, yeah. So, what was he going to do?
Well, I mean, the whole idea is that the Rangers stand on the bridge so none may pass. You know, that they stand alone if they need to be. So I can see a Ranger wanting to. I might be one guy in a fighter, but the Analyst Shock never backs down. And if I can get in there and even stall them, it gives the possibility, you know, some sort of action, because they're an order of action.
Yeah, but not, you at know, the risk of not being able to convey the message back.
That's my point. Lanier recognized what the bigger mission was, and that he had to endure watching others perish so that he could get this information.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, yeah, there that was.
See, I can geek with the best of you.
You are you're doing great, Jeffrey. No, you do not give yourself enough credit sometimes. So you know, Sheridan's comment, I like when Linearc finally comes back. Hands him the data crystal. He says, "This we've been working for this for months, and now I want to toss it out of an airlock." But
yeah, I mean, you saw him. He did care. He's like, "Thank you for bringing this to us. I'm glad you're safe. Go get some rest." And crap, now that I have it, I don't want it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Because that's what leads to the next part of it. With Londo being locked out of what's going on. And that's another one of those things where a bad choice was made for noble reasons and is boomeranging back on them. Remember, the inner circle decided not to let Londo know about what their suspicions are because they were concerned for Londo's safety. But what's happening is now they're in closed sessions and secret sessions, and all it does is raise Londo's suspicion.
It's worse than that because he was already tipped off by the minister saying, you know, they're out there fabricating evidence, so be on your guard. So they already put him in a mindset to be defensive. As soon as something was mentioned, and then you have this closed session where it's a parade of evidence, where first it's
Frank. That's the next episode. You're getting ahead of us. You're getting ahead of us, Summer. Yeah, no, this is just they're gathering the evidence, and Veer, he's briefing Londo, and all the normal everyday businesses have been canceled.
Right.
Yeah, I loved his comment too. It's like, you know, Veer's like, it's like nobody trusts anybody, and Londo's like, nobody's ever trusted anybody, but it's never gotten in the way of doing business.
So. In the way of doing business.
I'm sorry, Meningate is having too much fun. Stop playing with the computer and putting all kinds of graphics up on the screen there.
I can't see it. It's no fun.
It's ridiculous.
He
is a man who just needs more juice in him. More juice and less buttons.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yes, we have our evidence and what to do with it.
Yeah.
And then what else we had?
There's all kinds of things. I mean, we still got Lita's deal with Jakar.
Yeah, Lita and Jakar are finally coming to a business arrangement.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she instigates that one.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, which is sort of a different dynamic.
Yeah, right. And that was one of those things. If I remember watching that the first time, and I mean, yeah, we knew that Jakar's character had changed and that he'd gone through changes and he was not the same person, but it was really driven home in that first meeting where Lita mentions, you know, 6 years ago when we first met, you wanted to, talk about exchanging DNA, you know, either by cloning or you know, and the way he says it, or by a direct mating. You could tell there's like almost this embarrassment. You know, but it's not like that embarrassment. Oh, an awkward situation. It's like Jakar is able to recognize how I'm trying to find the right word. How
he's become sensitive enough to realize that she's in a desperate situation and doesn't want to be in the position to take advantage of her.
Right. There's that, but also that what. The Jakar back then was an insensitive lout. You know, that the reasons he made that offer were purely for personal pleasure, if you will.
Yes.
you know, using official business as a ruse to get something that he personally wanted. And, you know, and that selfish Shakar is long gone. But as he says that, you know, you can see him, he's like, wow, I can't believe I was ever that misguided or that so insensitive. You know, I mean, it was just, it was, and all it was just the tone of the voice and the lowering of the eyes. And, you know, we talk about how great Andreas Katsoulis is, and that's just another one of those moments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you guys ever had seen the, there is a wonderful blooper from that scene. You may recall or have heard that the studios were on the flight path to Burbank Airport, just blocks away from Burbank Airport. And so we forever dealt with the horrible noise of dealing with it. And in that intense moment when Lita is trying to pitch her, you know, it's like, okay, it's time to make a deal, and here's what I'm thinking, and I need a lot of guns, and I need a lot of money, and I need a lot of all of these things, and I need that plane to stop running, and because we did it over and over and over, and she finally, I don't know if you ever saw that blooper, but it's hilarious.
No, I've never seen that. That's great.
That one.
Need that plane to stop going over. That's great. you know, later on, they come back, and Jakar tests Lita.
Mm-hmm.
Know, basically trying to see where her moral limit was, you know, and says, okay, you know, can you spy on other governments for us? And she says, nope, I'm really desperate, but not that desperate, sorry.
And it turned out to be the right choice, because now he realizes that he can trust her, because otherwise it would have been literally the powder keg 5 miles long shining in the night, and she right. was the fuse.
Right. Well, you know, it's always struck me that, not saying that this was bad writing, but that always seemed to me to be kind of not quite in character for Jakar to have that, to do that kind of loyalty test. I mean, I understand why he would do it. And I would understand, you know, and I get where he's coming from, and I mean, again, it's not that it's like poorly written or anything. It's just like it just doesn't quite ring true for me that Jakar would be that engage in that kind of deceit, looking for a particular answer.
Why not? He realized how much he's changed for the better. He wanted to make sure that she hadn't changed just as much towards something dark or worse yet. And because if she was willing to break that trust, which had already gotten a whole lot of people in trouble when Byron's people were on board.
Right, yeah.
You know, he could never be certain where he stood with her.
Right, no, I get that. And I'm not saying that it was an inappropriate response. It's just, I guess here's the thing. Jakar in the fifth year has become a very a straight talker. Okay, he doesn't hide anything. When he wants to say something, he says what's on his mind, and he does it very diplomatically. He's also the way he says things. If he does it to upset people, he does it for effect. You know, I'm thinking of all the scenes where he's in the Centauri court, and you could tell he's doing that just to tweak noses. You know, some of his comments. Mm-hmm. But when it really mattered, I get the sense that Jakar was, I'm going to tell you exactly what I'm thinking, no deception, so that you know that I'm coming to you from an honorable place. And I guess really that's it. It's that little test, a loyalty test, if you will, that seems a bit dishonorable. Again, I'm not saying it's wrong. It just didn't seem like it quite fits the character with where he's going.
I disagree. That wasn't a loyalty test to him. That was him trying to find out where she stood, where her own core was at that moment in time.
Right, exactly. She had put her offer up by when she said, whatever it was, 5 years ago, we made this, you had asked and you had inquired. So why all of a sudden after all this time, are you switching? It's I'm sorry, but I just remembered something that Doug Netter said to me in a business environment, and it was a lesson learned, you know, and he taught me about it. He's like, you know, Jeffrey, everybody in this town has an agenda. The trick is to understand what their agenda is and then meet their needs. And that's exactly what you're saying, right, Summer? I mean, Jakar, it wasn't
it wasn't a deception.
It wasn't a test. It was like, so let's cut right through it. What are you really, what's your motivation? What's your purpose? What's your need? And how far?
I'm seeing actors now. What's my motivation?
Yes, you're a telepath, see? And you're looking for homeworld. And then this lizard guy, he's going to, he wants to like do it to you. Or maybe not. I don't know.
Yes, and I love her little exchange at the end of that. And it's like, you know, I just recently discovered I don't have a pleasure threshold.
Pleasure threshold, yeah.
that's like one of the best lines in the whole series, you know. That worked out. That was
Jakar's reaction.
Yeah, Jakar's reaction of, well, it just is priceless. He's like, ooh, okay.
Oh.
Yeah, right. I'll be in my
priceless
bunk.
Yeah.
Now see, on the flip side of that, at the beginning of the episode we also get the creepy Lita.
That was
Garibaldi.
A dream.
I don't think it was a dream at all.
I do think it was a dream.
No, not a dream at all. Yes, not at all. No.
Why not?
Because it was too real.
Why would
because,
she him to play with?
Because there's no symbolism involved. Let me put it to you that way. Okay, that's the one thing we can say in the Babylon 5 universe, with the exception of maybe Londo's dream, where we don't really get to see, well, I guess we do. You know, there's a lot of symbolism involved, okay? And Garibaldi's dream right in that opening, it's fraught with symbolism. You know, friends lying dead on the deck and written in blood things that, like, you know, where were you? You failed me. You know, his own meeting his own dark self, the counter rising up to consume him. Lita's just sitting there looking at him and says, I've decided to stop hiding what the Vorlons have done to me. And then looks at him and goes, I had no idea.
I see.
That was just too creepy to just be a dream. I'm sorry.
I disagree. And here's why. He woke up from his own dream, or he thought he woke up from his own dream. His psyche has been banging at him about the drinking. We already know he's paranoid. We know he's curious about how far, you know, that's one of the things. Lita did a whole lot of stuff while Byron was there. That just can't, is way, way beyond a P5. He's known for a couple of years. She's way beyond a P5. So that was kind of on the edge of his psyche when he came up from his dream. And he wondered about it, and then he woke up again. If she had said, you're not going to remember this, why would he ask Lise, did you see anybody leaving here? You know? Come on.
But that's the point. Because it was real. And the fact of the matter is, Lita really wasn't there. She was just projecting herself into there. That's what I'm saying. In the same way that Kosh was able to project, you know, now he used more symbolism to speak to Sheridan, but Kosh was able to project himself, if you will, into Sheridan's dreams. But that was real. That was real in the sense of, I'm trying to find, you know, for Kosh, he was trying to find the way that he could best communicate with Sheridan. And that was using the symbology of his father. But he also was communicating to him while he was dying and under attack by the shadows, okay? So by the same token, that's what Lita's doing, getting into his head while he's dreaming, but it's real. Okay, I'm not saying that she was physically in the room, opened the door, walked in, sat down at his bedside and watched him twitch and turn. And then told him to go back to sleep and then opened the door and walked out the hallway or whatever. What I'm saying was she's just decided, I wonder how far I can push this. Garibaldi, you know, it's true you can write into somebody's brain if they're having strong emotional thoughts. That's been established in the B5 universe.
Mm-hmm.
That guy's a mess. Let's just take a look. And also, he came looking for me for some reason, you know, and it's like, well, let's just take a look. I had no idea.
And that's what makes it think that it's a dream for me, because later on, when he asks for her help, she is surprised that he's drinking again. If she was in his head, she would have seen that, especially with his defenses down while he's dreaming.
Huh, okay. Hmm.
I think that was just a manifestation.
Okay. No, that's good point.
Of his paranoia, of, you know, because we all know Garibaldi does two things great. He's suspicious and he's paranoid.
Yeah, all right. Okay. All right. I can see that. I still lean toward it. She was actually there. But I'll have to take that under consideration. I'll have to give that some more thought. Now, the other thing that I have been wrestling with, because I knew it would come up, the glowing white eyes. And given my general distaste for the glowing red eyes and the Drox and how cheesy that is,
mm-hmm.
I want to make it clear that I don't find Lita's glowing white eyes cheesy. And here's the reason why. We've gotten to know Lita over 5 years, basically. We've seen her in the same way as Jakar change into a different person. Okay? That's the glowing white eyes are one of those kind of changes that becomes creepy as opposed to cheesy. Part of it might be the color. You know, glowing mm-hmm. red eyes are automatically associated with evil monsters. You need your 3D glasses, kids, to see the evil red eyes coming at you.
Yeah, well, that reminds me of looking at Meningay.
Yeah.
Michael Drac Meningay. Yeah. But with Lita's, you know, it's indicative of a transformation. I guess that's why I keep coming back to it being real, is because maybe that's just hindsight, knowing what happens to her at the very end of the series makes me lean toward it being real. And of course, the scenes where she's channeled the shadows before or fought them, and she's had the completely black pit eyes and the blood pouring out of the tear ducts and stuff, that's like, ah.
Okay.
So
we will discuss this later, I'm sure. This will continue for much, much longer, just like Day of the Dead.
Yes, I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will.
Did we hit everything?
I think we did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we've got it.
Yeah, but Garibaldi's like, fresh air is a bad luck charm for me. I can never eat there again.
Yeah, bad stuff always happens.
Yep. But yes, we are embarking upon war.
Yes.
That's where they leave it.
Yep.
That's where we will leave it. And we'll pick it up next week with All My Dreams Torn Asunder. Which is a great title. I love that title.
Yeah, that's a good title. Well, we'll talk about that next time.
Yes.
All right. I think it's time to take a break.
As a black snowfall blankets the failed cities on Christmas Eve, The arrival of 99 mysterious steel chambers sets a series of far-from-blessed events in motion. 8 people become links in a deadly chain that will either tether innocent lives to safety or strangle any hope for their future. And as each part of the story unfolds, we learn that above all things, Christmas in the failed cities is a feverishly struck balance between the constant threat of violence and the briefest, most bittersweet moments of joy. Variant Frequencies presents The Failed Cities, Half a Darkness, by Matt Wallace, starting on December 1st and ending on Christmas Day.
Feedback. Our listeners love us. They keep calling. They keep emailing. What questions do we have to answer today?
Why is Tim such a dork?
Are they still asking you?
And how did he ever get a radio show?
That's the joy of podcasting. You just do it. You don't wait for somebody to ask you.
Are they still begging you to relent on your irrational stance?
Like you said earlier, Day of the Dead is going on and on and on and on.
Hello, Babcast. This is Ken Phillips again. I'm calling it regarding the feedback episode, I believe it was 170, in which you're discussing Day of the Dead. And normally, I like to agree completely with Tim, just out of the uniformity of all the Tims and our ability to take over the world at any time we wish. But, I do partially agree. Warden and Lanier didn't necessarily work. I do like the whole metaphysical quantum entanglement, whatever you want to describe it as. But I will present my alternate writing of the episode so that maybe both parties can be satisfied. So, we draw this line in the station. Let's make it, instead of just on the floor, let's put it on the floor and the ceiling. We'll have our ritual, and when the ritual initializes, we will have some electrochemical reaction take place in the substance of the line, creating a electromagnetic field that rebounds all radio waves and maybe light waves and just about anything else so that they just can't contact inside the bubble. So they haven't been moved hundreds of thousands of light years. They're just completely sealed off and cannot contact or move through the barrier. They're just so that's my alternate rendition of how Day of the Dead might have been better. And all I have to say is, I live for the one, I die for the one.
Okay.
I just have one thing to say to that.
Mm-hmm.
Shenanigans. Because here's the thing, all right? If it's a religious celebration, the Day of the Dead, okay, I'm good with that. It's where you start trying to use scientific explanations to rationalize or quote-unquote make more real the faith for the non-believers. In other words, I guess this is kind of the analogy that I'm thinking of. You know, in Catholic communion, you've got the notion of transubstantiation. Now, when the priest offers up the bread and the wine, it actually transforms into the flesh and the blood of Christ. Okay, that's part of the tenet you have as a believer in Roman Catholicism. But I would wager if you ran spectral analyses on those substances while mass is going on, they still remain bread and wine. Does it make the ritual of communion any less real for the believer? No. So the whole notion of trying to find reasons of physically making this portion of the station move 80,000 light years or have this shimmery force field come down is just – it's irrelevant at best and nonsensical at worst. I'm working on my rewrite.
I addressed that. Need to do some research to find out how many Brachyri were alive at that point in time. Because that ties into my explanation that you might be able to hang a hat on. I say might. I'm going to give you real proof, real example from here in this plane of reality that give us possibilities for how this works, including from two known, well-known quantum physicists.
All right.
Purveyors, giants in the field of quantum physics and quantum mechanics. So,
how many Brachyri does it take to move a mile-long section of Babylon 5 to another part of the universe?
I'm going to say at least 30 million.
Three.
You guys are so scary. You really are. Mangair and I are just shaking. We just can't take it. You just.
You have no idea.
Oh, and to Tim.
Stop fighting.
And to Tim out there, I just have one thing to say. There can only be one.
Let's hit another voicemail before the show goes into the next month.
Hi, this is Andrew from Tucson. I'm calling after listening to episode 178 that featured the first one, Troy Rutter. And the subject of the original gathering came up. And I made me dust off my Columbia House version of the gathering. Remember Columbia House? No. If you want to purchase the next episode of Babylon 5, simply do nothing. It'll be mailed to you automatically. Well, since I haven't seen the original gathering, I signed up and canceled as soon as I was able to. By the way, I still also have a copy of Midnight on the Firing Line. Money well spent. It made me also think about how the pilots of Star Trek, the Menagerie and the Gathering of Babylon 5 had things that were similar. And since I'm on the phone, I have to use some sort of mnemonic, so I'm going to use PAW, P-A-W, Props, Androgyny, and Wasser. On how these are similar, well, their props needed work. Certainly from the Menagerie, I remember these phasers that reminded me of tomato soup cans. And over in Babylon 5, when Sinclair and Garibaldi needed to make that stop before seeing the alien, you know, they went over to the armory and picked up cardboard and lots of electrical tape to make that rifle. Next up is the use of androgynous aliens. Remember over at, Talos 4 with the those keepers, they had that twitchy brain thing going on. How wonderful was that? And then, of course, the character of Delenn was supposed to be androgynous. And this brings us up to Leonard Nimoy's portrayal of Spock and Ed Wasser's whatever he was, freedom, war. And those actors seem to go from that school of acting called Can You Yell Any Louder, Please? So it was nice when the series finally got picked up, how both Nimoy, Spock, and Morden became these smart, cool, calculating characters. But, you know, since Morden's kind of sinister, I'd rather compare him to Spock's character in Mirror Mirror. Well, I'm not quite sure. Ask Alice. I think she'd know. So until next time, use your head.
Very nice, very nice. Tell it like it is. Keeping it real.
Hang on. Yeah. We got Babylon 5, we got Star Trek, we got Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah.
In there.
With Alice in Wonderland reference. Yeah.
I don't get the Trek references, so you're gonna have to.
Okay, well I get the comparisons there. He's, you know, with the props. Frankly, I like those old style phasers that were in the Star Trek pilot because they had like lots of moving parts. So I didn't think they were that cheesy, especially compared to that weird rifle thing that was in The Gathering. So I get that. The androgyny, it is interesting that the Talosians were actually played by women, even though they were given alien masculine voices. They weren't deep, but they were definitely not female voices. But because the actors were women, they carried themselves in a different way. So there was that sort of alien disconnect between the voices and the actors. And as Andrew did point out, you know, one of the original concepts for Delenn was, you know, when she comes out of the cocoon, not only would she be part human, but she'd be female, which would have been a revelation. And then, yes, in both pilots of both Star Trek pilots, the original Cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before, Leonard Nimoy spends a great deal of time shouting his lines at the top of his lungs. It is very humorous. Yes.
Okay, then.
I would give an example, but I think my wife would probably cut my tongue off if I did. But yeah.
I will agree with him on the props part, because I did not like the handheld guns in the Gathering. They just looked cheesy.
Yeah. They looked futuristic.
All right. You have now maxed out your time. Menengay has pulled out the single hair that was left in his head.
I cannot
say. Did he give us that one finger that says it's time to wrap it up?
Well, that's what he used to pull the hair out with. Yeah, it was kind of strange. Mixed messages. I'm not sure.
Nicely done. Nicely done. All right. I think we're good. We're good.
I think we're good.
We beat that dead horse. Yeah.
Yes, we did.
And we'll dig it up and beat it again. Just wait.
Tune in next week for another whooping.
There you go.
On the day of the day.
Yes, if you want to submit your own feedback, that email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. We're Twitter-pated now. If you want to follow us and get all the latest updates on when the live feeds are going up and sometimes the news, go to twitter.com/babylonpodcast and follow us. Come to the website, babylonpodcast.com. Leave your comments. Join in the, I'm going to say, rugby scrum, because people are still arguing about Day of the Dead and a few other things that we've talked about. And also, if you want to call in your own voicemail and leave us a question, a speculation, or a reason for Tim to agree with us finally about Day of the Dead.
It'll never happen.
That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year that Tim makes you all see reason.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.